The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we're going to talk about the latest in health and healing, really cutting-edge information, including the latest conference by a group of geneticists in Ireland, showing that there is no reason we can't live to be 150. I'll give you my thoughts on just one simple step that we can all take that could add at least 15 years of quality life onto our existing lifespan now. Also, we'll be doing this afternoon, I had a very interesting guest. We're going to be talking about something that I don't believe has been discussed with any relevance, and that is, how do we denuclearize our world? How can we do that? Get rid of the bombs, get rid of all these threats, and put all this in proper perspective. I'll talk with the general about that. Also, Hillary Clinton in the State Department is celebrating the war criminal Henry Kissinger, while the White House repeats his deadly mistakes. Now, I've had a chance, and I want to thank the people in this audience who've sent me excerpts of Glenn Beck and Sean Hannity and Michael Savage and other individuals really praising Kissinger and praising the neocons and saying that we lost Vietnam because our government did not give the troops and the general support. I will show you how all that's a lie. He talks about history. I'll give you the actual history today of how everything was done wrong in Vietnam, and it had nothing to do with the government of Vietnam not receiving all the support and our generals the support and our troops the support. I'll give you a different perspective of why we lost Vietnam, why we should never have been in Vietnam. The very people who put us in Vietnam are still around today and being celebrated, and how that celebration will teach us nothing about why we are in Afghanistan, Iraq, and in all probability, we'll end up in Iran. So, on a social conscious level, and every day I'm doing something to raise our social conscious, to give a different perspective on the events that are not being discussed, not on Keith Olbermann, not on any of these programs. So that's what you can expect in this hour and our 3 o'clock show. But my guest is in the United Kingdom, Rob Hopkins. We have to start with him at the beginning of the show. Everything else will follow that. Listeners may remember when I did a broadcast during the summer of 2009 with Sister Miriam McGillis, founder of the Genesis Farm in northwestern part of New Jersey. I went over to Genesis. I filmed her, and you will see what they're doing, which I consider just terrific, just such a good group of people with such a good idea, in the new film on how to be a healthy vegetarian, which is far more than being a vegetarian or a vegan. I go into genetic engineering. We just finished all of our filming of Dr. Shiva and many others in India and in Pakistan and the Himalayas. And we're also looking at organic and what is and isn't, and how bad products can be marketed as organic. So it's a real conscious-raising film. In any case, now a global grassroots movement to harness the creativity and knowledge of local communities and towns and cities to apply their skills in preparing for a post-peak oil world. So we have with us today the founder of the Transition Network movement, Rob Hopkins. He's been a long-time practitioner and teacher in the permaculture movement and natural building and architecture. And after learning about the challenges the world communities will face when peak oil is reached and less petroleum will be available to sustain our oil addiction, he embarked on a journey to motivate communities to begin preparing themselves for what will come. What started as a small endeavor in rural English towns has now been embraced by over 30 communities in the United Kingdom and is rapidly growing, probably 500 worldwide. Rob is the author of the textbooks on transition culture, including Transition Handbook, From Oil Dependency to Local Resilience, published by Chelsea Green. And he's with us now from the United Kingdom. Nice to have you with us today.
Hi, Gary. How are you doing?
Good. I would like just a little bit of background. We are now being told in the United States, I don't know what you're being told in England or in Europe, that thank goodness the recovery is in full swing and that we have gone past our recession, that we are rebounding. And they try to show some indicators for this and say, so there's really no need for any type of transitional movement. And a lot of Americans who otherwise were at least open to the idea have sighed relief and say, thank goodness we don't have to make any fundamental changes in our lifestyle. All we have to do is just watch Fox Network and learn that there is no such thing as global warming, even though yesterday the hottest day in the history of L.A. Occurred at 113 and could have been hotter, and we really don't have to give up any of our lifestyle qualities now. So for the vast majority of Americans, we now are lulled back into this false sense of security that all is well. All we have to do is vote in the Republicans and vote out the Democrats, or vote in the Democrats and vote out the Republicans, and they have the answer to sustainability. And then they tell us, the Republicans tell us, what we're going to do is simply do what we've done in the past. We're going to follow Reaganomics. We're going to shrink government, expand the military state, but everyone's going to have more of what they want, quality of life. The Democrats are going to come around and say, well, the problem is the Republicans, and we're going to create a bigger government programs, greater safety nets, and the average American is now between one or the other. However, and this is where we go with you, there are now approximately 42% of all registered voters are now defining themselves as independent. They were at one time Democrat or Republican, but now they are not. They see that our lifestyle cannot be sustained indefinitely. Many people, including baby boomers, are now realizing that what they had planned to do with their life, they can't. And so many of the, not many, I will say a relatively small number of independents are now becoming progressive, meaning they're seeking positive solutions that will benefit all who choose to participate in fundamentally changing the nature of the paradigm, which means some radical shifts in consciousness. That's where we begin our discussion with you. Now, if you would please, uninterrupted by me, take us on the journey of explaining what you're doing, where you're at, who's participating, what you see the benefits to be.
Well, we're about 4 years into what I think of really as one of the most fascinating social experiments being done anywhere in the world, which is really based on the question, what do our communities need in order to be able to thrive and sustain themselves beyond the age of cheap energy and all that that has made possible? So it's really, it started out very much looking at peak oil and climate change, and something about it has taken off quickly. As you said, there are now over 350 formal initiatives, many hundreds more at an earlier stage. And transition is really a solutions-focused response, which says that maybe rather than looking at this as an enormous crisis, we should be looking at this as an opportunity. And I agree with you entirely about the whole economic growth paradigm. There was a study here recently which said that if the UK manages to get back to 3% economic growth, it will use between now and 2040 more resources than the country used basically since humans first crawled out of the swamp. You know, we live on a finite planet, and while peak oil tells us that actually perpetual economic growth is just a ridiculous worse idea, because you can't do economic growth without cheap energy to make it feasible. Climate change says, economic growth will kill us. Basically, it will overheat the planet very, very quickly. And so transition is really about saying, you know, here in certainly globally, I think any chance of a binding international agreement, as was attempted at Copenhagen around climate change, is just dead in the water. And really, it's down to individuals and communities to take leadership on this. And so what we argue is that, firstly, we need to move away from the idea of economic growth to a new way of looking at prosperity, but also that the local level can drive a lot of that. So I'm talking to you today from the UK, as you said earlier on. So here in the UK, we export as many potatoes to Germany as we import from Germany. We send as much milk and cheese to Holland as we import from Holland. And at the same time, we're unraveling all of the local agricultural systems that would have supported us. We are finding it harder and harder to employ our young people. And we argue in transition that actually the way forward now isn't to go back into thinking that economic globalization will solve all of our problems, but rather it's about economic relocalization, not in a sort of let's build up a put a fence up around everywhere and not let anything in or out kind of, you know, you could imagine a quite unpleasant manifestations of localization, and maybe some of us even remember growing up in some of them. But we argue that there's actually a much healthier way that we can do that, which is based on social justice and the ecological principles, but which can actually meet many of the needs that we have today, starting really with food, energy, and building materials, and that it's that that can really start to put our communities on a much more sustainable footing. So for us, it's not so much about sustainability. We argue that it's more about resilience and looking at how do we make communities more resilient from the ground up. And transition is really a simple process, a simple set of tools which has proved remarkably viral and contagious around the world, which kind of gives people the permission, in a sense. It's like it's a pulse that people pick up and they think, yeah, we can do this. And actually, maybe we can actually become better connected with each other through doing this. Maybe we can have more fun by doing this. And ultimately, I would argue that this process of building resilience and localization actually fundamentally meets the needs of the things that make us happy as human beings much, much more than the way things are currently done at the moment.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you. We do not have a history in the last 40 years in the United States of being resilient with other individuals. In fact, those people who have been resilient have only been resilient in that they didn't want what they had lived up to that time changed. They didn't want their neighborhoods changed or their schools or curriculums or their jobs or their security changed. So with one mindset, we have no choice but to understand everything is changing at every level, in every institution, in every paradigm, including the body politic. The trouble is we're about to see the effects of chaos theory in politics. We're going to be electing some individuals, at least here in the United States, who are nothing more than anti-establishment, pro-alt-right-wing radicals. These are not progressives. They're not independent. And they're not very bright. In fact, I'm embarrassed to say that we are probably going to hatch the most illiterate, uninformed, misinformed, and biased politicians in America's history. And all because no one else knows what to do to fix any of our problems, and no one in power has the power to fix our problems. So we're not going to have a top-down solution. So therefore, when I'm looking at, I'm saying we really do need sustainability. Because at the end of the day, when you're living in a beautiful environment for 30 years in the suburbs and everything's fine, and then four houses within your block go into foreclosure, and then 2 months later the plumbing's been ripped out, two of those houses are now drug dens, gangs are marauding in the neighborhood, services are depleted. Even if you had been a person who went to the farmer's market and supported locally or grown produce up to that point, that is going to have to give you a different bearing of, are you able to even save that neighborhood, rejuvenate it, turn it around, make it work at some level, or are you going to be looking at where is the next place I have to be if this is not going to be sustainable. And right now, we do not have a sustainability effort in the United States. We do with words, but I'm doing this new film on poverty, Poverty Inc., Made in USA. And I've been filming thousands of individuals at every level, local, town, big city, small city, suburbs, rural, desert, mountains, everywhere. And I'm finding that we just have an awful lot of people who know the problem but are absolutely not engaged in the solution. I'm not saying this to be a Cassandra. I'm saying this simply to say that I'm seeing a reality here that you are absolutely not seeing over there. Your reality is different because you come from a background and a history and a culture of being resilient. We haven't had that yet. Maybe this will galvanize us into. We even have groups called shared living groups. And it all sounds great until you actually start to share space with people. You realize, well, that didn't work. What's next? Where's plan B? So take us through how this works on your end so we can learn if it can apply to us.
Well, I think part of it is you know, there's an idea that somehow community is something that we have to build from scratch, you know. But, and very often my experience here anyway, being involved in the environmental movement for many years, was that somehow the language that the environmental movement used and the way people dressed and came across and the way that people tended to largely kind of just talk to other people who agreed with them meant that those ideas kind of got fairly stuck in a sort of alternative left-wing sort of ghetto that it was actually quite comfortable in and quite pleased with being in, really. So in transition, it's one of the things that's very important that we really try and encourage people to go beyond that and to talk, to engage with church groups, engage with local politics, engage with the local business community and this kind of thing, and find a language where there's something in common, you know. And so there's lots of places here anyway where county councils are engaging with transition, because also what we do is we take out of it the sort of blame culture and the judgmental side of it. You know, so many environmental things start with whose fault is this problem, so that we can go and protest against it and chain ourselves to them. And actually, our approach is very much, well, you know, what do we have in common with this? What do we have in common with these people? You know, but as you were saying, you know, certainly I think increasingly that the culture in the UK, where maybe, you know, where I am here in Totnes in Devon, I can walk down the street and I can see 450-year-old buildings built using local materials that were bought here on the back of a cart. It's more tangible somehow. The idea that it's possible is still kind of built into some of the urban environments around us. So I think certainly in the U.S., talking to a lot of the transition groups there, they're really having to kind of rework and reinvent transition and make it their own and make it more kind of appropriate to their cultural setting, which is really what we're seeing around the world. You know, people say, well, would transition work in the developing world? And what we're starting to see now in Brazil and Chile and places is people picking up transition, which is designed as a loose kind of a model which gives people the basic tools to get started, and creating their own transition based around their language and their culture and so on. So certainly what we're seeing in the U.S. is the emergence of a much more kind of U.S. Specific version of transition in that sense.
One other issue, food sustainability plays a key role in the transition strategy. With respect to food self-sufficiency, what have you found works and what doesn't at a small community level?
Well, I think there are some projects that you can get started very quickly. So, for example, we have a project here in Totnes, which is about planting productive trees in urban spaces. You know, it's really the last 50 years that we've perfected the art of designing totally useless landscapes and breeding plants specifically to be completely unproductive and useless and calling them low-maintenance shrubs. So it's the idea of putting productive fruit and nut-bearing trees back into the town. It doesn't take a great deal to organize that. We've planted a few hundred of them now and starting to get almonds in local parks. We have a garden share scheme, which is about matching up people who have a garden they aren't using anymore with other people who would like to garden but don't have space. Very easy to run again, and there's about 40 families now growing food who weren't able to do so before. We run training on food growing, that kind of thing. But then other bigger projects like sort of reorienting local markets to local produce and reconnecting farmers to local consumers, these kind of things take longer again. We're working with estates around the town who manage large areas of land to try and engage them in the idea of connecting to local markets and producing for those local markets. So some things happen quicker and other things take longer. But what's good anyway here is that there are across the country there are a number of really good projects starting to emerge from other transition groups like food hubs, which make local food available affordably to local people, urban market gardens that are starting to put food production in the urban context, and communities buying new land, bringing it back into community ownership for allotments or for community farms, communities who own their own farms. These kind of things actually don't take that long to create and to put into place. So certainly in most transition projects, it's the food projects that get started. It's much quicker to get a local food project going than, for example, to put up a wind turbine on the edge of your community or to start a housing development, something like that.
Good. That's very, very good. My last question is, there was an important article by William Bowles published on the Global Research News site in Canada over this past weekend that I read. It was called Peak Oil, Why Not Peak Water? Essentially, Bowles' argument is that oil is still a global force of the corporations and wealthy oligarchy. Many people can survive without oil, but water is something completely different, and we're losing available water rapidly, especially clean drinking water, since most is laced with chemical pollution. Do you see any ways in which the transition network could also be addressing the peak water world as well?
I think, you know, certainly if we were to sit down and draw up a list of all the different things that the transition movement could be focusing on, it would be a very long list. It's not just, you know, as Richard Heinberg's book, Peak Everything, made out, you know, we are actually reaching the peaks of lots of things. We're on a finite planet and there's lots of us. So certainly there's, you know, peak water, but also peak phosphorus, which is essential to agriculture. Some people even argue that, you know, we've peak soil in terms of the state of the health of our soils globally. So, you know, there are many different things, and certainly, you know, for example, in Brazil, they find where the perception nationally is that they're sitting on a vast amount of oil, which is going to make them very rich and very powerful. Peak oil as something to focus around isn't something that's really necessarily engages people, but peak water is something much more that is, you know. So my sense is that really what we focus on in transition is the concept of resilience. And how do we make our communities more resilient, more able to not just withstand shock, but see putting in place the infrastructure to withstand shock as a step forward, not as a step back, and as a potential for an economic, cultural, and social renaissance. So whether it's peak water, peak oil, it's really about that. You know, what does that look like on a local level? And that seems to be what's really kind of engaging people at the moment. But certainly there are places where the question of peak water is already very, very, very real and very pressing.
Rob Hopkins, to you and all the others involved, I thank you very much and wish you only continued success in this effort.
Pleasure. Thanks for your time.
And the book is Transition Handbook and the website transitionculture.org. I'm Gary Knoll. A couple thoughts on sustainability in a few moments, some commentaries, and then a lot on health and nutrition. Please stay with us back in a moment.
Always mashing in the head.
commentary from Lynn Din. Welcome to the recovery from commondreams.org. Soothed, fortified, and frankly vindicated by the cheerful effervescence that the recession is indeed over, I set out for a walk this past Saturday morning. No doomsdayer am I. I'll refute anyone who says we still have problems. If not tasering outright all unpatriotic spoilsports who would point to crumbling factories, empty malls, and capsized mortgages as evidence that we're eternally shafted. Our elevators are still, well, they're still working. Thank you. Except for those in aforesaid factories. Speaking of shafts, is that a foot sticking out of the puddle? At the corner of 9th and Washington, there's a quaint sign, avoid foreclosure, and then a number to call. At the corner of 7th and Washington, we buy houses for cash, no bank needed. Strutting towards Philadelphia's brand new casino, Sugar House, I pass a billboard promising me personally $23 million if I had the juju and stamina to outfox the Pennsylvania Lottery Board. Lucky favors the righteous. And that's us. All right. Soon, every bum dibbling settlement from sea to shining sea will have its own casinos. Do bet on it. There will be more certified dealers than players. Speaking of bums, there are more idlers than ever. What's up with that? According to these gaseous experts, the recession has been over since last June. Let's get on with it. Yet these dazed loafers just keep sprawling all over town, all over the country, actually. Just look around you. The newly homeless are easily identified by the stuff they're trying to hang on to. They pull wheeled luggage, push carts with way too much on them. They're relatively clean for now. Soon they'll let go of everything. On the median of Delaware Avenue, a man walks back and forth with a classic sign, homeless and hungry, please help, God bless you. Well, poverty isn't very original, is it? But I've also seen free advice, donations accepted, help support my marijuana habit, or need money to get drunk. So two women can take me home. It's not cool that jokers are mixing with genuine beggars, but we don't have beggars anymore, do we? Only panhandlers. A couple of months ago, a visibly messed up old man in Detroit said to me, I need $9.50 for my prescription, mister, I beg you. But he wasn't a beggar. That's third world, isn't it? Actually, he wasn't even a panhandler. I started the conversation. On a freeway ramp in downtown, people stood with signs begging like they do all over America. Just look around you. In Richmond, I talked to a Vincent who grew up in Syracuse, then studied at Penn State, divorced with two children, 22 and 16, and he had worked as a registered nurse most of his life. His last job was a waiter at Red Lobster. Business was bad, so they cut his hours. Then they let him go. He took out a title loan, but then he lost his house, lost his apartment, lost his car. Vincent had been on the streets for 6 weeks. His oldest kid was in college. The younger ones had been living with him until everything fell apart and they had to go to their mom. This last fact humiliated him more than anything else, he said. I've been broke many times, but I've never been homeless more than once. I've gone to the supermarket with 26 pennies, the exact price for a packet of instant noodles. I waited until there was no line so I could brave the cashier alone. Once, getting uppity, I counted out 159 pennies for a can of Spam. As I added up, a line formed behind me. Once, down to $2, I bought a loaf of bread and a stick of butter and survived for several days. I've made ketchup soup. Thankfully, those days are long gone. I've moved to the upper reaches of poverty. Never say never, however, which is instantly the slogan of a new GMC ad. Bumper sticker in Detroit, quote, out of a job yet? Keep buying foreign, unquote. On license plates of the same car, quote, I work for Ford. I drive a Ford. After a 3-mile hike, here we are, finally, inside the casino Sugar House, serving up drinks and cleavages. Slim waitresses weaving through the lardy crowd, made jiggly by decades of trans fat and fizzy corn syrup. Baby boomers, most of them, judging by weight per year end, we're not yet a poor country, so they say. In the semi-dark, gamers are fixated like dumb infants by the cartoon characters, blinking lights and bright colors of the slot machines. Gold Rush, African Diamond, Fortune Cookies, Cash Fever, Cash for Life, Cash Inferno. Those are the titles above the slot machines. Tired of being mugged, folks? Well, you can take a breather by glancing up at a football game on TV. From an unseen corner, a live band plays classic rock. Ads for casinos are always filled with perfect straight teeth smiles, white and black or beige. They are all tickled stupid by serial windfalls. For mere pocket change, they get to climax over and over, it seems, until kingdom come at least. By contrast, real-life chumps are uniformly grim. Suckers only laugh as they walk in, if that. Bored with this spectacle, I head back downtown. On the way home, I would pass a group of Israelites railing that the white man is the devil and that God hates faggots. Next to them, a white guy holds a sign, "Screw these asses." I would chance upon a man evacuating himself on Market Street, one of the city's two main arteries. By City Hall, I would see a woman coughing so violently that she may not make it through this winter. This is your America, America. But don't worry. We've been told the recession is over. I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Message for President Obama. Please, sir, look out your window. Over 100 protesters, according to Jeff Bigers from Common Dreams, from the Appalachian coalfields were arrested in front of your house, sir, the White House, yesterday. They were defiantly calling on you and your administration to abolish mountaintop removal mining as part of the Appalachian Rising events. The coalfield residents took part in a multi-day series of events to bring the escalating human rights, environmental, and health area crisis to the Capitol. Kentuckians for the Commonwealth leaders Terry Blanton and Mickey McCoy, the first arrested in today's nonviolent act of civil disobedience, were joined by allies from around the country, including Nassau's climatologist Dr. James Hansen. Meanwhile, protesters led by the legendary Reverend Billy Talon staged a nearby sit-in at the office of PNC Bank, which remains one of the last major financiers of coal companies engaged in this extreme form of strip mining in Appalachia. In a stark reminder of the national connections to the coal fields, the Obama administration officials looked on from their White House offices as their electricity came from coal-fired plants, generated partly from coal strip mine from Appalachia. As a litmus test of the administration's commitment to science and the law, rule of law, Appalachian residents are calling on the EPA to halt any new permits on the upcoming decisions over the massive Spruce Mountaintop removal mine. Mountaintop removal coal only provides, in fact, less than 10% of all coal production. And fed up with the regulatory crisis and the circumventions from outside coal companies, coalfield residents have been rising up against reckless strip mining practices against the country, from Alaska to Alabama to Arizona. I'm Gary Knoll. Your turn. Your turn to speak out. Here is our number to call in and share your voice. Share your concern in a media that's lost its voice, except for those high, shrill, and irrational individuals on the extreme media. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. And this afternoon, I'm going to be giving you a real a real history lesson, not a Glenn Beck make-up lesson for political and economic means, but a real history lesson on Vietnam. You will not want to miss that. You will not want to miss this. It will correct a lot of the misinformation that's out there now that's continuing to allow our country to spend enormous money that we need here in these absolutely savage, worthless, and nihilistic wars. I'm also going to... I was sent an email by someone who said that Glenn Beck made a comment, and assuming this person is accurate, or even partly accurate, that, you know, we should go back to the basis of the founding fathers who discovered America and what their principles were. Really, Glenn? Well, that's going to be another history lesson, because I'm going to show you the actual historical facts about the motives of the people who founded America. That'll be at 3 o'clock. I'm going to take your call as soon as they come in. I have some health nutrition information to give you, and a lot of it. But we're going to take one little quick two-minute break here. Why? Because I just returned. I got some phenomenal footage. Depressing, yes. Makes you angry to your core. But you, when you see this new film, and it won't come out until the spring, because I have two other documentaries, on one on Greed Street, which is my Wall Street film, and Death by Medicine coming out ahead of them. Death by Medicine, I'm hopeful, will be able to be premiered when I go back to the city in 3 weeks. But this is all about poverty, a new face of poverty. Now, I did this down in Louisiana, down in the bayous, down in Alabama, in Cottonwood, over in Arkansas. I show you the old poor, meaning the poor that historically growing up we understood as being poor. I show you the poor in Appalachian. But no, this time I'm showing you the new poor. The people with BAs, MAs, masters, PhDs, people who were lawyers, doctors, engineers, school teachers. I'm showing you the new poverty and what caused it. How did it happen and what can be done about it? And you just can't help when you're sitting behind a camera seeing these people and feeling it. And you're going to get a lot of that in this film. In any case, I'm just 2 weeks away from finishing my photography on this. I don't have a chance to eat in a lot of places. First, I only eat organic. And second, I'm not about to eat anything that someone's going to contaminate my body with something from there. So dirty hands and all that. So I just take my own stuff with me. And I get super energized because it's super energizing food. About 3 weeks ago, I introduced a new product. It was called Super Muscle. And it's vegan and kosher and it's living food. But then I started to realize it takes me a long time to invent something. But a lot of what I do is inventing. And I love inventing. I invent a lot of things. But this is one of the things that the reason I invented Super Muscle was because a lot of people are going through a financial crisis right now. A lot of people, I mean, I would have already signed and bought a particular piece of property, but I don't have the money at this moment. Hopefully within the next 6 months I will, if it's still available, because it will be the ultimate community. I'm going to take this whole concept of sustainability, not for people to adapt to the circumstances they're in by transitioning, but rather transform their crisis into a whole new, wonderful world of opportunity and quality of life. But it still has to have money to buy the initial property. And that'll happen. I'm always confident. I never worry about those things. Just keep doing the right thing, and sooner or later, you get another step closer. But I'm realizing not everybody can do what ideally they should do. Now, in a perfect world, if you were not limited, you would have each morning everything that I believe your body needs to energize the cell to do its wonderful work on the DNA that you've damaged, on protecting the DNA that is not damaged, on helping every single one of your 100 trillion cells. That would be red stuff, greens and grains, berry blast, supremacy, heavenly aloe, and muscle. Reality, most people can't do that. I just got a letter sent to me from a reverend. I don't know who it is. Evidently, he was on, well, I won't mention that, but he's a reverend. He was just talking about, you know, how much he appreciates what he can afford, though he can't afford much right now. He's going through a rough time. But he says he noticed an enormous difference in how he feels when he just takes one product. And that's what caused me to make Supermuscle. Because I wanted to put as much of what I could into one single product. So I wanted to be high protein, at least getting, for most people, half of their total protein for a day, 26 grams. I wanted to be raw, but in a form that would be sustainable and all natural, gluten-free, dairy-free, soy-free. I also wanted to have the nutrients that are not duplicated in other products, but would really combine. So I wanted about 3 servings of vegetables. I wanted cocoa. And then I put what really makes a difference. I wanted brown rice protein, hemp protein, split pea protein, flaxseed, sunflower powder, the organic canola powder, the vegetable concentrates. So there's a good amount, 1,000 milligrams. The acai berry, the maca root, red tea, green tea, mulch green tea, the black tea, the white tea, the spirulina, the Lohan Quo fruit, chlorella, lipase, protease, cellulase, NADH, and 10 billion living probiotic bacteria. 10 billion. And an ORAC, antioxidant factor of 5,000. So you put all that together, and then when I came back with the formula, the manufacturer called me and said, Gary, the amount you want to make this viable, I mean, if you were giving 10 milligrams of, you know, green tea, but you're not, all these teas are 150 milligrams, totaling 1,000 milligrams about. And you're giving, you know, lots of servings of fruits and vegetables, and it's 5.5 pounds. 5 times the size of your muscle. 5.5 pounds. I said, do it. He said, well, this is gigantic. We don't even have a jar that, you know, this big. So they had to wait for 4 weeks to get a jar. It's a humongous 5.5 pound jar. It's big. But at least for those who need one product to cut across everything, to give them the best of everything in one product and save money, this is it, Super Muscle. And today, as a fundraiser for this station, because every penny goes to this station, I don't accept anything. I do it purely as a public service. You will receive what would have been a discount price of $140 for $100 just today. That's it. Call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. I designed this to be a meal replacer. I designed it for people who wanted to get the energy producing, the phytonutrients, the chlorophyll, the antioxidants, the polyphenols. I took from all the other and put it into one, including the best quality protein. It's soy-free, wheat-free, dairy-free. It's Circle K kosher. It is high ORAC. It is delicious. It's everything, and it's 5.5 pounds. 5.5 pounds. You know, it's bigger than a gallon jug. Call 877-627-5065, and I have reduced it down to the bone. So I gave you all that I could in one product. So at least for those who are on limited income, you at least have something that will give you a full spectrum of super potency, super powerful, super great nutrients flooding your body. And I take this. I take it a couple times a day, and I'm taking a lot of everything. That's how I keep my energy up to work 20 hours a day and travel all over the world. Call now. This is only today. Let's say hello to Al from JFK Airport. Hi, Al. You're on the air.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Doing great. Thank you.
Oh, very nice. I just want to make a small commentary on the depression and the saying the recession is over. And I really want to say thank you for that because it's so true. You look around and you see so many things that are right in your face. And with me, life has hit me in the face, and I have a limited income, just like you were talking about, and it's hard to raise a 5-year-old son, which, again, I will say thank you because I've listened to your methods and your ways of taking care of an autistic child, and he's doing wonderful. But I just want to say that what do we do, Gary? What do we do with this life? You know, people like the other people on Progressives, like Richard Martin might say, you got to move out of the country, and then there's other people talking about, you know, you got to start thinking about a better place to live, and it's very hard, Gary. It's very hard. I'm at a point that I listen to you guys, and especially to you, and it becomes very hard to understand where to go and try to maintain a budget,
Al, here's what I'm going to suggest. That I would share a difference of opinion with Richard Martin. He has a lot of good information to share, but on this one we do not agree. I believe that we cannot cut and run. I love this country and all the gifts that it has. I don't like how it's managed right now, and I don't like how its resources are done. So I'm putting virtually all of my energy into creating a sustainable project that will give insight, information, and practical tools, and for some people, not a lot, but at least for some, an actual place to live. And I'm hopeful that this will be a template that other people around the world, other progressives around the United States, will begin to realize that we can literally create lives of quality based upon barter, exchange, because not everyone has money, but actually increase the qualities and of life instead of decreasing, because the current system is that you're going to keep adapting down. You won't see things get better. You are not going to see anything in the suburbs and these major cities or the boroughs get better. It will only get worse by systems being cut, services being reduced. And then on top of that, climatic experiences. Imagine the people who living out in Wisconsin. You know, they're still having floods, or lived in Iowa, the floods. They had never experienced that before, but now that's routine, not realizing. And yesterday, the hottest day on record in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And that's routine. So what we have to do is we have to pull back and go to neutral. We have to be very objective, and we have to be clear-minded and say, all right, where is it least likely and where is it most likely to be able to have a quality of life? And then you look everywhere. And you have no biases. And you say, okay, there's a wonderful place out here. It's beautiful. Yeah, but it has no water. The water tables are down. What do you think? I had to say no on this property in Houston on Sunday. Why? Because the water tables are down, and I could only think maybe 2 years, and suddenly I'd be running out of water. So even though it was a great buy, and that's one of the reasons I believe it was a great buy, I had to pass on that. But that would have saved a fortune in building. Okay, so now what's more important? Building structures using all green materials, having homesteaders participate in their own process, but having unlimited quality healing water and great soil. I took the water and the soil. So you have to keep your judgment of not just making a decision what's important today, what's going to be important a month from now. What if you have children? What if you are older or younger? What if you're still working? You have to build into your equation something that addresses everyone's needs. What if you're a homeless or not a homeless? Let's just say you're a poor single-parent artist. You must also show that you have something that helps everyone. So it is helping everyone at every level that becomes the template. I don't believe in excluding people. I'm a big believer in inclusion. I will not accept it is a viable option that you only do something for people who are rich or educated, or you know, because that's not the majority of people. So if your initial programs include everyone, then everybody has something they can benefit from and everyone can have something to gain. For example, this winter, when I finally get through these current things I'm doing, I intend to do a series of workshops over the Internet on homesteading.
Yep.
So no matter where people live, they can go to the Internet, they can listen for this two-hour lecture I'm going to do and answer their questions so they can get started.
Exactly. That's what I'd like to do, too.
So, you know, how to start your own home-based business and how to do things so you can join with other people to grow food and share. One person grows sprouts, another person grows lettuce, another person does hydroponics, and how you exchange and barter. All this is doable. It's all positive. There is no downside. There's only an upside, especially when you see, as I do, the tsunami of pain coming at us.
Mm-hmm.
And I will not accept that anyone in a position of power today has any answers that are going to be applied because of the enormous impact of powerful groups and institutions and corporations and elites who ultimately decide the outcome of everything, except for those people who no longer are supporting him. And when you go off the grid of power, no longer accepting them, then you start looking for the alternatives, and the alternatives are there. So I see a positive future for those who are making their minds more independent and are therefore going to survive. All right, Al? So we'll be helping you in the very near future. Ernie from New Rochelle. Hi, Ernie.
Hi, Gary. Thanks for all your comments. I specifically liked one yesterday about watching TV and being lost in this world of imagination and things. But the question was about the economy. You know, you keep seeing the stocks going up. It's been going up for the last 2 or 3 weeks, and then it's back down again.
Those are manipulations. Those are people playing the market.
What if we have a little bit of, let's say, money invested in these mutual fund and things like that, what will be the best course of actions to take with us?
All right, we're going to say goodbye to our WMYE audience. Thank you very much for listening. And we will continue over the Internet at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com or GaryNull.com. And this afternoon at 3 o'clock, you won't want to miss the real history of why we lost in Vietnam and why we're going to lose and are losing in Iraq and Afghanistan. I own no stocks. I own no bonds. I do not believe that I want to give anyone else the power to control my future by controlling my resources. I started telling people in this audience 3 years ago that their best investment will be in just pure gold coin, not these ads that you see on television, because you'll lose your money on that. They're taking a big commission. They're having you buy, you know, antique coins, or none of that matters. What you need to do is buy gold when you can, and not a lot of it, because I believe it's going to hit 2,000 in the next 12 months, then 3,000 after that. Because I see a really big drop in the American currency. But get yourself out of debt, whatever it takes. I believe that we're going to drop 20 to 50% from where we're at right now in the value of real estate in the next 24 months. I'm going to put up next week a whole stimulus, progressive stimulus package on my website. It's written. It's just that we're rushing to finish tomorrow. We're launching tomorrow a major information and activist website on vaccines and autism. And it's really taken a long time and a lot of effort by a lot of people to get this going. So our energy is on that. After that, then the stimulus package goes up. I believe that you should be getting out of debt, holding cash, and just keeping yourself liquid. It is not about making money at this point. It's about saving what you have. I do not trust any of the institutions because many of the states cannot fund their pension requirements. New Jersey and New York have been able to, and California can't. I see states which cannot technically go bankrupt but can certainly be downgraded to the point where their bonds become useless and a lot of those bondholders are going to lose their money. I don't believe there is any such thing as an absolutely perfectly secure bond today. And I would, for myself, and this is true for most dynamics, you are much better off holding your resources in liquid form, because that will be worth much more when you do decide whatever you're going to move and however you're going to move. You will have the money at hand to do something with it. So I would make myself liquid and stay liquid. And the more liquid you are, the better you will be in the next 2 years. And remember, most of what you see on Wall Street is an illusion. When they say the economy and gross domestic product is increasing, they are looking at things that are not real to the average person. The financial sector represents up to 22% of the total profit, but that is a relatively tiny amount of people making astronomical amounts of money, mm-hmm. but it still counts towards our, oh, gee whiz, look at our economy. No, look at the rich, rich people's economy. It is not my economy. It's not your economy. And then you have to look at the fact that banks are holding 4.7 million homes off the market that they've repossessed,
mm-hmm.
because if they put them back on, in any number, the price of the existing homes in the market would just drop like a lead balloon.
Correct.
But that means that we have an enormous inventory, and that's a hidden equation. It also means that 50% of people who now have mortgages are have no longer the profitability of their or equity in their mortgage, and their many are underwater, and it's never going to come back. It is never coming back. I don't say that to cause fear. I say it for people to be realistic. People are waiting for their jobs to come back. Most jobs will not come back.
Mm-hmm.
Those jobs are being exported. So we have to be practical about how we're looking at the world we're in today. And more on that when I do my programming on sustainability
Thank
for the
you,
future.
Gary.
All right?
Thank you.
All the best to you. Mike from Manhattan. Hi, Mike. Your turn.
Hello.
Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Mr. Noll?
Yes.
Yes, sir. I have one question. I need your help. I had a one stent done about a year ago. They put me on that Plavix blood thinner, and I really want to get rid of it and find something naturally, another one, instead of using that. They want me to use it now for the rest of my life, and I don't think I want to use that.
Well, there's some physicians, and this has to come from a physician. It cannot come from me. But there are physicians like Dr. Raphael Kelman, who could help you with that. He's in Manhattan. And I sit with them, and they can show you the way that you can wean yourself off. Are there ways? Yes, there are. So they are not correct. So all you have to do is get with a physician who can help you with that. I'll take one more call here from Josephine from North Carolina. Hi, Josephine.
Hello, Gary. How are you?
Doing great. Thank you.
Good. Gary, I have a question, but I also have a comment. Is that okay?
Sure. Happy to hear both.
Okay. Thank you. My question is, a friend of mine smokes very heavily, and she wants to quit. And I looked in your nutritional almanac and cannot find anything about quitting smoking.
I don't have anything in there on that, but here's the best way of doing it. I help a lot of people quit smoking and quit drugs and quit alcohol. I call it the 13th step. So first, watch the video called Overcoming Addictive Behavior. Then look for two steps. The first is a detoxification step. You've got to get rid of the gold glucose poisoning. You've got to get rid of the nicotine and the addictive opiates that manifest in the brain after you smoke. So you need to go through about a three-month detox, rich in chlorophyll. I suggest wheatgrass juice, 5 times a day, 2 ounces. Also, a good rebalancing would be to take the nutrients that are known to impact very positively upon a person's brain chemistry. Now, the best brain chemical rebalancers, especially for people who are addicted to marijuana, alcohol, smoking, and cocaine and heroin, would be uridine 5-monophosphate, and then also phosphatidylserine, which is a compound bound to DHA and promotes already normal neuronal cell membrane function and structure. Also, alpha-glycerylphosphorylcholine, which boosts acetylcholine, which is a critical neurotransmitter that declines with age, but it's very, very important in people with addictive behavior. Also, vinpocetin, V-I-N-P-O-C-E-T-I-N-E, which enhances circulation and oxygenation to brain cells, both of which are constricted by drugs, initially stimulated, like with cocaine, but then constricted with alcohol and cigarette smoking. But it also improves neurological electron conductivity and protects against neuron-destroying excitotoxicity. Then phospholipid grape extract, and that bound together results in a compound that's better absorbed into the bloodstream, where it improves blood vessel tone and elasticity, thus enhancing better circulation oxygen flow to the brain. I would also use wild blueberry extract, which protects against free radical damage from the smoking or the drinking or the drugs in the brain, and helps maintain the fluid balances already between the normal range. And then also there is an ashwagandha extract called Sensoril, S-E-N-S-O-R-I-L, that helps alleviate mental fatigue by inhibiting an enzyme, which is a acetylcholinesterase that degrades acetylcholine in the aging brain. And you see a lot of that problem with people smoking marijuana. Also, hops, ginger, rosemary, and pregnenolone, which is a hormone that can be especially beneficial to the brain when people are trying to detoxify. So that is what I would do to get a person started, and also I would have them read or watch Overcoming the Dark Side, the 3.5-hour documentary I did, which is crucial for people who are trying to alleviate addictive behavior. Okay?
That's wonderful. Thank you, Gary. And my comment is, I have to say thank you from the bottom of my heart. I've been on your protocol. It will be 1 year in January. I had so many things I'm not even going to tell them over the radio. But the things that I do want to tell you, my C-reactive protein before I started your protocol was 4.9. 6 months later, it went down to 2.36. My temperature when I got sick 9 years ago went down to 97, and I knew there was an imbalance somewhere, and now it's up to 98.2. My hair is black, and when I got very, very ill, when the doctor said there was no hope for me and they sent me home to die, I went on your protocol with you and Luann, and my hair is 98% black. I only have a little curl in the front that's white, and I can't get it to go black. I can't believe the progress that I've had. The only problem is I'm still not able to walk around, but I have to thank you again. You are the most awesome person on the planet for the things that you're doing to help people like me and everybody else. And, Gary, I don't know what I would have done without you.
Thank you. I'm happy to see that you're doing so well. And this year, let's work upon getting you to walk, all right? All the best to you, Josephine. Coming up next, Animal Magnet Pet Radio. Deborah Wolf. I'll see you in 2 hours, everyone.
The Gary Knoll Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Carol Lee.